This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you trying harder and harder to get things done? Stop it. Stop it right now and enjoy your life. You might live longer and help save the planet as well. That's the message from Cecile Andrews, author of Slow is Beautiful. Now Cecile has a new book out this year called Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and a Lasting Happiness, co-authored with Wanda Urbanska. But why be so serious about it? Cecile's speech made me laugh out loud, and she wants you to have fun too. Here is Cecile Andrews, continuing her talk called Simplicity.
And so something I like to read out of Slow is Beautiful, because it's always struck me as something that really summarizes what it is that we're talking about. And it's by a man named Robert Lane, who's an emeritus professor at Yale. And he talks about the effect of the way we're all living. And he says that there is, my hypothesis, he says, is that there is a kind of famine of warm interpersonal relations, of easy-to-reach neighbors, of encircling inclusive memberships, and of solidary family life. There is much evidence that for people lacking in social support of this kind, unemployment has more serious effects. Illnesses are more deadly, disappointment with one's children is harder to bear, bouts of depression last longer, and frustration and failed expectations of all kinds are more traumatic. And so everything is just worse without this social support. And so this is the thing that, you know, that you're going to have, is it next week or the week after on the September, on the whole eco-village, and we have this whole thing going. Okay. And then we're going to have, you know, somebody here from the Vancouver Village, and we'll talk a little bit more about this. But this whole idea that we have to give people this understanding, the importance of social ties. And so, I'm always trying to think, how can we do this? And then I found the words of someone, Saint-Exupéry, who did The Little Prince, and he said that if you want to have someone build you a boat, you don't just gather people together and give them the wood and the plans and the tools. He said, no, what you do is you teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Don't you love that? That's how you get people to do something. You teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea, which means what we have to do is give people this vision of community, of letting them know what it is. And in many cases, it'll mean letting them experiencing it. But it not only, of course, makes people happier and healthier, it's better for the environment. I mean, we're working very hard to save the planet, but often it's just by giving people a bunch of facts. It's telling them little things that they can do. But if we help people come together in this sense of joyful community, they don't even want to go out and consume. They don't want to shop. They don't want to be the richest person in the world. And so we have to come up with a way to do that. It's also going to help democracy because Robert Putnam in his book Bowling Alone says that, and this one I love, this is again particularly good for the states, that the culture in which people talk to each other over their back fence is the culture in which people vote. Isn't that incredible? It's like we can go out and do all we want to try to get people interested in politics, but if we got them to talk to their neighbors and got them involved in community, they're much more likely to vote, to be involved in all sorts of ways in democracy. And of course, this is how we get people to care about the common good, because they're experiencing being cared for. So with this vision that the way we really bring about change, whether it's simplicity or in the environment, is to have people have this vision of community. So what are the barriers to community? Well, to me, the big barriers are, first, that we don't have enough fun and we don't have enough time. And the subtitle to my Slow is Beautiful book talks about joie de vivre. Now, I can at least come to Canada and you guys can say that. Nobody can say that anymore in the States. And, you know, people used to be able to say that. Nobody even knows about the concept of joy of living, joie de vivre, because I think it's because people don't have any use for it. They don't think about the joy of living, so they don't even have any words for it anymore. But this whole concept of joie de vivre, it's like, you know, we're supposed to be enjoying ourselves. And it's really true that what we want to do, and again, I'm going to come back to ask you about this, in the States is not have fun, not enjoy ourselves. We want to get a lot done. We want to be productive. We want to achieve, and we want to be number one. Isn't that strange? I heard somebody in one environmental group in Sustainable Seattle, and we were having a big meeting, and she stood up and she said, "We want to make Seattle the most sustainable city in the country." And I thought, what's this about? You want to be number one? What do you mean? You want to... I knew what it was. They were worried about Portland. You know, it's like Portland was taking over. But isn't that bizarre to have this worked in to this concept of somebody, we want to be number one in sustainability? So this whole sense of getting people to understand that they're supposed to be enjoying themselves. One of the books that I really like, I'm sure a lot of you like Barbara Ehrenreich's work, her last book, Dancing in the Streets, A History of Dancing in the Streets. She says this is so important because she said this is the thing that the people in charge want to get rid of, because people who are willing to dance in the streets are people you can't control. Isn't that a great way to look at it? People who know that what they're supposed to be doing is enjoying themselves are hard to control. But you can control the people who want to be number one, who want to be successful and achieve, by giving them all sorts of little rewards. So this is something that's particularly, and even though I don't even think we're very good in the whole United States, we're particularly bad in Seattle. We're really kind of repressed people in Seattle. You know, kind of go around with kind of frowns on our faces, out to save the world, but we're not having a whole lot of fun. Even in Palo Alto, they're doing better than we are. And this whole sense then of joie de vivre, but then the other thing that struck me that we have to have, and again, I think Canadians are better on this, but you still only have, what do you have, 2 weeks vacation? Is that what you have? Is that what is that you have given?
Generally, yes.
What?
Generally, yes, 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And so we're way behind Europe, that this whole thing of leisure, of taking time off. And when I first did a lot of reading about leisure, the thing that struck me was I could see that nobody, I wasn't brought up even thinking about leisure. The only thing that came to my mind was like leisure suits. Did you guys have leisure suits? You know, and I think there were these ugly polyester gray things. And it's like we don't even have, again, a word for leisure. But for me, this idea, it's not just about having more time, but like taking your time, moving slowly. I had somebody say that to me in a store the other day. They just said, "Oh, take your time." And I thought, "Oh, I haven't heard that for a long time. Take your time." She said, "I have plenty of time." And this sense of having the opportunity to think and feel deeply, that without leisure you can't do that. And the person, of course, who sums that up the best for me, that I have a quote from, is Thoreau. This is probably one of my favorite Thoreau quotes. He said, "I love a broad margin to my life. Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sit in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie, amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sang around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun falling in at my west window or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time. I grew in those seasons like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands would have been. They were not time subtracted from my life, but so much over and above my usual allowance." Don't you love that? Now, if you start your day out reading that every day, your day will go much better. That you have this vision of taking your time. And it's interesting because I had this kind of a same experience. a couple of summers ago when I had just hung my sheets out to dry in my backyard. It was one of those beautiful days that we get in the Northwest. Like was it beautiful here yesterday?
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's sunny, but it's not too hot. There's a teeny little breeze. And so I had hung my sheets out to dry, and I sat down in my wonderful outdoor chair, and then all of a sudden I realized that it had been 45 minutes, and all I had been doing was watching my sheets dry. I mean, the breeze would come, and they would billow out a little bit, and I thought, and you could see they were getting lighter, and I thought, I've been watching water evaporate. And I realized that a few years before, I would have thought, oh my God, 45 minutes? You know, I could have gotten something read, I could have written something, I could have done something. And I realized that this was the most important thing to do, was to be able to sit there and watch my sheets dry. Now, when you do that, what you do is you don't feel like running out to a shopping mall. You don't feel like getting busy. You feel like taking your time. I also have a quote from another favorite writer that she really says this well, from Virginia Woolf. She really sums all this up. She says, if people are highly successful in their professions, they lose their sense. Sight goes, they have no time to look at pictures. Sound goes, they have no time to listen to music. Speech goes, they have no time for conversation. Humanity goes. Money making becomes so important that they must work by night as well as by day. Health goes. And so competitive do they become that they will not share their work with others, though they have more than they can do themselves. What then remains of a human being who has lost sight, sound, and a sense of proportion? Only a cripple in a cave. Isn't that good? I mean, this was 1937. And she just summed it up, that money making, at least, and again, when I talk to Canadians, I think, you know, you're not as bad as we are in the States. But you could be. And that you can look at us as a cautionary tale, you know, that we don't want to be like them. And so this whole thing of one woman said in one workshop, and she said, you know, she says, we all think that someday we'll start living. And that's what we're all trying to do, someday. And so I used to go before, like me and my husband, quit our full-time jobs. I used to go while he was still a full-time reporter, and he'd be sitting there at his computer working and typing away, and I'd say to him, this is it. It's probably not going to get much better. And so he would look up and go back to his typing. But I know he did get through. I got through to him. So what else can we do besides trying to give this vision and create this, that there is something that's more important than money-making? One, the facts. Facts don't work for everyone, but there is one particular fact. You know, every once in a while you discover a fact that's like, whoa. Because I really can't remember many facts. I was an English major, and that must be an English major, right? We didn't have to have facts. But this one fact that seemed to me so important, that the biggest indicator for the health of a country, health of a nation, as measured in longevity, is the gap between the rich and the poor. And they have done this research over and over and over, and they have found this to be so true. The bigger the gap, then the longevity is going down. Now, you know, a lot of people think, well, this is because poor people have poorer health, and that's part of it. But the biggest thing about it is when you have this gap, it destroys social ties. When you have that gap, everyone becomes very competitive. Other people are your enemies. They're not your friends. Trust has gone way down in the States. I mean, when I think of that young woman, you know, coming up and you know, yelling at this older woman trying to park. But when you have this gap, this gap, everyone is trying to claw their way up. And when people have this you know, somebody has lower status than they are, they treat them differently. And they treat them as if they're not as important. And it's like everybody, though, has somebody who's more important than they are. So nobody has this ease and this sense of social ties that people have in countries with a lower gap. Now, Canada has a lower gap than the U.S., and this is one of the reasons I said that you always seem more intelligent to me. And it's very true that they have found that this gap causes, it accounts for crime, it accounts for obesity, it accounts for mental illness, it accounts for all sorts of things, that instead of having all these different programs, you work on this. Now, this is the thing that, for me, again, one piece of research found that people who came to the United States, Hispanics who came to the United States and still only spoke Spanish and lived together in their separate little enclaves, did not suffer the effects of having lower social status until they went out and started commingling with the rest of society, that then they begin to feel the effects of status. So what it says to me is one of the things that we have to do is create these separate, these communities where people feel equal, where people feel valued, where people can be themselves, and that has some mitigating effect on the other consequences of the gap between the rich and the poor. So it seems to me incredibly important. And so this is where, and we'll talk later about the Village Vancouver, that this whole movement of people creating communities, particularly in their neighborhoods, to bring people together. And I live in a community in a neighborhood in Seattle called Finney, and we have formed a Finney eco-village. It's not a real eco-village. It's just we have a whole bunch of them now around the Bay Area. Have any of you heard of scallops? I mean, not the seafood, but this is, it's an acronym, Sustainable Communities All Over Puget Sound. Isn't that clever? Scallops? And so we have all sorts of neighborhoods in Seattle. We have Sustainable Ballard, Sustainable Queen Anne, Sustainable Capitol Hill, Sustainable Ballard, Sustainable Fremont, and it goes all the way up to Bellingham, down to Olympia. We have over 45 of these communities. And then we come together. And what we try to do within each neighborhood is to create community and to work on sustainability. But the community has to come first. And if you have community, sustainability follows, because you begin to share. You don't care about going out and shopping. And you begin to think about the common good. So some of the things that we do in our neighborhood, I want to give you some examples. One of the things I particularly focus on is bringing people together to talk together. I had a friend who said to me when she saw me starting yet again another small group, she said, "Oh, Cecile, you're doing it again. You must have been a sheepdog in a former life." And I thought, yes, indeed, that's what I am. I go around barking at people's heels, trying to herd them together. And it's nice to know your essential identity. Actually, there is a little quiz you can take that helps you figure out what kind of a dog you are. Yes. And so what we do, of course, one of the things we have is a voluntary simplicity circle. And it's so important, and this is what I've been working on over the years. It's so important when you're trying to live more simply to have some kindred spirits to talk to. So people, you know, they can, because if you, people are talking about their favorite thrift store or what they saved their money on, or, you know, other people can look at you as if you're just really strange. But here, everybody knows what you're talking about. So this is one thing, to get a simplicity circle going. We do something in one of our local bookstores in our neighborhood. We call it, it's the name of the bookstore is Santoros, and it's called the Santoros Subversive Salon. And this is different than a lot of book discussion groups. Now, it was interesting because I had been in some book discussion groups, and I discovered that often they're very competitive, and that you go away from your book discussion group feeling horrible because somebody looked at you like you know, why did you pick that book? You know, why do you like that book? And then I read something in the New York Times that said there was a whole new field of therapy for people who'd been in book discussion groups because they became so competitive. Isn't that incredible? And so what we decided to do was we just come together once a month and we talk about what we're reading. And it doesn't matter, so there's no pressure. And sometimes my husband even cheats. He'll talk about books that he's planning to read. He hasn't even read yet. What we want people to do is not focus on the literariness. We want people to have the relationships. And it's when you're in those kinds of groups that you have this kind of laughter, that people are laughing just because they're together. And it has an incredible, you go away feeling really, really good. And so to have that kind of group, another thing that we did, we wanted to start a group that we called, well, the reason we started this group, when I lived in San Francisco once, I lived in this incredible street, Chestnut Street, if you know it, not far from the marina. It's one of those streets when you walk down, everything is there. So you never have to leave. You know, there are all sorts of cafes and bookstores and theaters. But in front of the cafes, there are always these old guys sitting there all day just talking, just hanging out and talking. And I thought to myself, that's what I want in my life. I want to have some place where I can just sit like one of those old guys and just talk. And, oh, see, you think so too? Do you agree? Well, so we thought, how can we do this? So we started at one of our local cafes in my neighborhood. But first, it was just we meet every Wednesday at 1 at May's Cafe. And first, we started calling it the Home Alone Group, because that's for people who were working at home. And you lose your community when you're working at home. But nobody liked that name. Apparently, they thought it meant they were losers. So they changed it to the Think Tank. And it's so much fun because we just gather. And the interesting thing for me is that these are not people who are my close friends. I don't see them outside of this group. But I've become so fond of them just because we come together just to hang out. No other reason. So that's one of the things we do. Another one that we really advocate, and it's more on the personal realm, and I got this from, any of you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry David? You know, and Larry David is this curmudgeonly old guy, and he hates to see people and stop and chat. You know, if he sees somebody he knows coming down the street, he thinks, oh God, he goes across the street so he doesn't have to talk to him. So I thought, this is what we need. We need stop and chats. We need to encourage people to go out into their neighborhood and stop and chat. And so we've made this kind of one of our projects to encourage people to do this. So you begin to think about how can you talk to people and you begin to make a difference. And not in a way that scares people, but in a way that invites people to respond to you.
That was Cecile Andrews talking about her new book, Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and a Lasting Happiness, co-authored with Wanda Urbanski. Andrews' previous books include Slow is Beautiful and Circle of Simplicity. The new book contains short essays from many helpful authors. For example, Sarah Susanska talks about the role of clutter in our lives, while David Corton works on connecting and caring. Find Cecile's blog at lessismoresimplicity.blogspot.com. You can download her full talk from the speeches section of our audio on demand menu at ecoshock.org. I'd like to thank Josh Reimer of VIP Video in Vancouver for his recording. So what do you think? Can we give up our compulsion to go for the fast lane, no matter what it costs the planet or our own sanity? Are you ready for slow talk, activism, and community building? Join us in reclaiming our lives from the machine. From San Francisco, you've been listening to Radio EcoShock on Green 960, online and radio, every Sunday night at 10:30.